Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Oh, there it goes, I think. Okay. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily for Wednesday, April 8th, 2020. On today's episode, we're going to talk about what we've been up to at the water cooler. This is Slash Film Editor-in-Chief Peter Serretta, and joining me on today's podcast is Slash Film Managing Editor Jacob Hall.
Hello, hello.
Senior Writer Ben Pearson.
What's going on?
Writers Y Tran Bui.
Hey, everyone.
And Chris Evangelista.
Hello, folks.
So Brad is out sick today. He is not able to join us, but he'll be here next week. So don't worry about him. We'll get a double dose of what he's been eating.
He assures us he is not the coronavirus. So send Brad your well wishes, but don't send him too hard.
Yeah. let's jump into what we've been doing. I don't think we've been doing much as a collective whole, but this past week, my dog Gizmo was making weird breathing noises, so Kitcher had to take him to the vet, which is interesting because the lobby of the vet is closed because of the virus, so they had like these squares in the parking lot, and each person had to stand in like a taped off square. And we took Gizmo to the vet, and it looks like he has the beginnings of a collapsed trachea, which is very common for small dogs and Pomeranians. So it's not something that we didn't know about because we had heard about that. But it's not to the point that he needs surgery. They gave him some antibiotics and some kind of medicine, and but he'll probably eventually someday need surgery to fix it. And even then, they say like surgery, it doesn't always fix it, but he makes like these weird like noises, like he can't breathe well. The vet says that it's not like he's suffering in any way. He just makes like a weird like like that kind of noise. So yeah, been dealing with that. We've been giving him antibiotics, which have been making him like stoned. So he sits there like staring at the wall, and he's kind of funny when he's like on his medicine. But that's the one big thing I did this week. Chris, what have you been up to?
I did two big things. One is I set my kitchen on fire by accident. I'm not a pyromaniac, so I didn't do it on purpose. I've been cooking more. I actually started cooking before the pandemic. It just happened to work out that way. And in my defense, I've never really cooked before this year. I just sort of started doing it out of like, I want to cook my own meals for me and my wife. And so I bought like a cookbook and, you know, all that stuff. But
are you finding it's like meditative? Like you're
it
like,
is. It gives me, it's, I like it because it keeps me from thinking about everything else, which is awful all the time. So I was making this thing and I had to drizzle it with olive oil, and I foolishly used this pan that didn't have like a rim around it. And I put it in the oven and the olive oil dripped to the bottom of the oven, and the oven literally caught fire. And luckily we had a fire extinguisher in the house, so I had to use that. The only problem is our kitchen is very small, so the fire extinguisher dust residue got like everywhere. So I had to spend like a full day cleaning that and scrubbing the oven because I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want it to kill us. So that was that. And
hey, you had to use antibacterial wipes all over your kitchen anyways. This was just an excuse.
That's true. Yes. So really, it's a good thing I set my kitchen on fire. And
Chris, was that a scary thing, or was it sort of like, damn it, the kitchen's it was, on fire?
It was so quick that I didn't really have. Like, what happened was there was, like, smoke coming out of the oven first. And, you know, that happens every once in a while. to people. So I wasn't too alarmed about that, but I opened the door and I probably shouldn't have done this, but I feel like, I think like opening the door got more like oxygen in there. And that's what, like, I opened the door and it literally looked like the burning bush from the Ten Commandments was in my oven. Like Yahweh was in my oven. And I was like, oh my God, there's a ball of fire in here. So I grabbed the fire extinguisher and I put it out. And, you know, the house was kind of smoky, but it was over before I could worry too much about it. Mostly I was just annoyed because then I had to clean everything up. And obviously the food I was making was ruined. So that was that.
How did your...
It was just an annoying fire.
Yeah.
How did your dogs react to this whole mess?
They were fine. They were indifferent. They were in the other room, thankfully. So nothing too bad happened. Then the other thing I did is I launched a new podcast, which is 21st Century Spielberg, which is based on the column I write for slashfilm.com. It's literally just adapting the column into a podcast. So if you don't want to read a lot of words, because those columns are long, here is your solution. You can listen to me doing the legwork for you. The first episode is now live. It's not up on iTunes yet. I am waiting for iTunes to approve it, but it's pretty much most other places. There's a link to it in the show notes. There's a link to it on the site. So please give it a listen, because it's a lot of work. Like it took me a long time to both record it and edit it, because when you're doing a podcast by yourself, there's a lot of pauses and there's a lot of dead air. And so I went meticulously through this, the whole thing, and cut out all the dead air and all the pauses to make sure it was listenable. So please listen to it, so my hard work isn't for nothing.
Chris, last night I listened to the first episode and I really enjoyed it. So
Thank you.
I want to say that.
Really, I appreciate that. Yes. If you out there listen to it, hit me up on Twitter and tell me you actually liked it, or tell me it sucks and then I'll change what I'm doing. I would love some feedback.
Yeah, I just want to say that 21st Century Spielberg columns that Chris wrote and now has adapted are among the favorite things I've ever edited and had published on the website in my tenure here. And the fact that he's made audio versions is kind of remarkable, because they're such an incredible undertaking as a project, and one that I feel reflects Chris's work as a writer, and to see him branching out with them is very exciting. So I'm going to say, like, if you're listening to this, you really should check it out.
Oh, well, I'm blushing right now. Thank you. I'm not used to such praise, so I really appreciate that, yeah. Jacob. Thank you.
Honestly, if I have only one criticism of this, Chris, is I want more. Is that, like your first episode is AI and Minority Report. And
right.
I feel like AI could have, like, deserved a whole episode, like a whole, like, 30 minutes on its own.
You know, I was debating whether or not to change it up. The column is it's two movies at a time, because... Yeah. As weird as it is, the 21st Century movies of Spielberg, like two in a row, sort of always complement each other. Like AI and Minority Report are both sci-fi films, and then the next two are The Terminal and Catch Me If You Can, which are both sort of like light, playful comedies, and it just sort of like worked out that way. So yeah. That's kind of how I think I'm going to stick with that, but you never know. You never know what happened, but I'm going to do this. It's going to be monthly, so the next one will be around May, and then so on, and I will keep going until I finish the 21st century filmography of Steven Spielberg, and then I don't know what I'll do.
Then you'll start 22nd century Spielberg.
Oh, wow. That seems unlikely, but you never know.
Yeah, yeah.
You heard it here. Chris can tell the future.
That's right.
Spielberg will still be alive.
Yes, he will be hundreds of years old, but still making movies. And so will I. I will be alive and still writing about them.
Hey, if any filmmaker has the money and, like, probably the connections with, like, you know, scientists to, like, make him, you know, a digital version of himself, it's probably Spielberg, right?
Yeah, it'll be like his head on, like, a robot body. Robot, yeah. Spielberg.
Yeah, totally. Okay, Jacob, what have you been up to?
We're so bored in our house that we renamed the days of the week, since time has lost all meaning and Saturday and Thursday no longer matter, because they're all the same these days. We don't leave the house. So we decided that each day of the week belongs to a member of the household. Sunday is Jack Day, which means that it's in honor of our dog Jack. Monday is Carl Day, in honor of our dog Carl. Tuesday is Fred Day, in honor of our cat Fred. Today, Wednesday, is now Fitz Day, in honor of our cat Fitz. Tomorrow, Thursday, is now Natalie Day, in honor of my wife. And Friday is Jacob Day, in honor of me. And Saturday is Everybody Day. So each day we exist no longer as a way to represent some structure to our lives and in our world or civilization, but as a way to say, hi, animal lives in our house. Today is your special day. Do you want a piece of bacon? Here you go. And that's how it's going to go. So like on Natalie Day, my wife gets to pick what she want, what we watch. And on Friday, I'll get to pick what I want to watch. And on Sunday, we'll give Jack the dog an extra treat or something. That's how, that's my life now, guys. That's what it's come down to.
See, but you have the right amount of people and animals in your house to make that work. Like, what if you had one less? Like, how would that how would you, you know, associate the days? Like, would it rotate? Would the days, like, would there no longer be a 7-day week?
Yeah, I think, for example, Peter, if you wanted to do your household but didn't want to keep it just you and Kitra, yeah, it was rotate on a 2-day schedule. The week not only has 2 days, and there are now, like, 18 weeks in a month. So there you go.
Wow. 18 weeks in a month. We don't – I mean, it already feels like that, but we don't need to actually make it that. HT, what have you been up to?
I ventured out onto the roof of my apartment for the first time. So this is something that my roommate and I had always been eyeing because we're on the top level of my apartment. And there's just one last staircase that leads to the rooftop of our apartment building, but we had never ventured onto it before. We were always kind of intimidated by just the idea of going up there. And we're very cautious about just being locked up on the roof accidentally, because that's just a fear of ours. So, but you know, we're not going anywhere. So, and we just wanted some fresh air that wasn't from our fire escape. So we went to the rooftop and it was really nice. There was actually a chair out there already that we were able to use to prop open the door. And we just hung out there for a little bit, drinking some beer. And actually at 7 PM, on, I think it was last Friday, on the other side of our building, there were two people in the building across from us that were holding sort of a sing-along for everyone to participate in. And they sang Lean On Me. It was actually quite nice. And, you know, we also were there when everyone participated in the clapping for medical workers around 7 as well. So it was, yeah, you'll probably be seeing a lot more just pictures of me on my roof, because the only thing we're doing right now is taking pictures of ourselves and just hanging out there and drinking. So that's all my Instagram is going to be from now on, probably.
Hey, if my limited knowledge of New York City from movies and television tell me anything, it's people in New York hang out on the roofs all the time.
Yes. And it's fun. It's really nice.
Okay, let's move on to what we've been reading. Chris, you are the only person on this podcast that has been reading anything substantial this week. So tell me about that.
Right. So this isn't a book. It's actually a series of articles. And I don't know how I didn't know about this. Grady Hendrix, who is a writer, he wrote like My Best Friend's Exorcism and Paperbacks from Hell and several other things. A few years ago on Tor.com, T-O-R.com, he did this thing called the Great Stephen King Reread, where he reread almost all of Stephen King's books. He didn't do the Dark Tower series, and he left out one or two other things, and he stopped at The Bazaar of Broken Dreams, which is a short story collection. And Stephen King has obviously published more books since then, because he publishes like 5 books a month. But this covers a huge chunk of Stephen King's career. It's like a series of articles of Grady Hendrix just like going over the books and the stories behind the books. And like I said, I don't know how I didn't know about this, because I'm a huge Stephen King fan and I read as much about him as I can, but I just sort of accidentally stumbled across this. So if you, like me, were unaware of this and you're a Stephen King fan, I highly recommend this, because it's really entertaining. It's really informative. Even if you're like aware of the stuff he's going over, it's still like articulated really well, because Grady Hendrix is a good writer. So I put a link to it in the show notes. It's definitely worth checking out.
Yes. Okay, let's move on to what we've been watching. Ben, last week on this podcast, talked about a show on Apple TV Plus called Home Before Dark. And this is from director John M. Chu. It stars Brooklyn Prince. She's this precocious, like, little girl who moves with her family back to her parents, her father's childhood home. And she she likes writing these like newspapers. She's kind of a strange kid, and she kind of suspects that there was a murder in this town, and she goes on this investigation to kind of prove it and find out who did it. I think that's probably the good setup for this. I've only watched the first episode, and that's not because I didn't like it. It was really good. It's really a strange show in that this feels like it should be a family friendly show on like Disney Plus or something, but it somehow is it's pushed up. It kind of gets the like a premium cable series like treatment. It feels like better than it should be, and it also like is, you know, has some very adult themes, like there's, you know, death and murder, but it's really about this kid, so it feels really weird. Like, I'm not like sure who the target audience is for this. I mean I'm in. It's just strange that you're getting this story about a kid like detective or kid reporter that has like, you know, Radiohead songs, and do you like agree in that sense?
I know what you're talking about. I think the violence and stuff like that is never, it's more alluded to than actually shown, which is why I think they can get away with it. And I actually interviewed John Chu and one of the showrunners about this late last week, so maybe we can link to that in the show notes. But they talked about how they really like sought to make this like a four quadrant like Amblin style experience that the whole family can watch together. So it's really designed for kids and adults and, you know, teenagers and everybody to be able to just like sit down on the couch and check this out at the same time. So that's the vibe they were going for. Whether or not they fully succeeded in striking the exact perfect balance to that at all times, you know, is going to be up to you, I think. But I definitely know what you're talking about. Yes.
Yeah. Did you end up finishing the series?
I did. My wife and I started watching it. I knew that I was going to be interviewing these people, so I wanted to obviously have some of it under my belt before that happened. I think I watched like the first four episodes before I spoke with them. And then afterwards, we were just like interested in the mystery behind it. So we just kept going and finished all 10 episodes in the first season. I think that it starts out a little bit stronger than it gets in the middle, which is, you know, typical for a lot of shows, I think. It sags just a little bit. There's like a subplot with the young girl's older sister that I really could have done entirely without. Like, I just did not care about the romantic exploits of that character at all. Anytime the show is concentrating on this 9-year-old journalist and the central mystery and her parents and her parents' involvement in this mystery and a separate mystery going back 30 years, that's where the movie, or I'm sorry, the show really flies, I think. So we were interested in the overarching mystery. We watched the whole thing. I guess I would just say, like, if you're the type of person that wants complete and utter satisfaction, and every single mystery to be completely tied up and by the end of the season, then maybe don't watch this. But if you're okay with like almost all of them being answered, then go for it.
No spoilers here, but I'm assuming this is setting up more seasons. Is why you're saying that?
It definitely has that vibe at the end. Yeah. I'll just leave it at that. Yeah.
Yeah. But I really love the, you know, Brooklyn Prince. I mean, hot take. She was amazing in the Florida Project. Just her character is so interesting. Like, she's seen all the President's Men like 36 times or something like that. She's like always like going back to it and getting some inspiration. It really feels like a show for so many different people, and I'm not sure if that's a good thing, but I'm in. I'm gonna watch more episodes of this this week, so maybe I'll catch up by next week's water cooler. But so I think we both recommend Home Before Dark.
Yeah, I think what you said is right. It has like a prestige sheen to it that makes it feel a little bit better than it has any right to be. Yeah. So I think it's better than a lot of, you know, normal run-of-the-mill sort of TV shows. So I'd give it a shot.
Yeah. In previous episodes of the podcast, we talked about Onward. A couple of us had seen it. And now, Chris and HT, you have seen it. Chris, what did you think of Pixar's new film, Onward?
Look, it's not a bad movie, but it's definitely like bottom tier Pixar for me. It's like one I don't think I'll ever revisit. The problem I had with it is it felt really, for lack of a better word, straightforward. And like, when I think of Pixar, I think of movies that, like, you know, when I think of the good Pixar movies, I think of movies that like push the envelope a little and do something you're not expecting. And like everything that happened in this movie, I was like, oh, that's really predictable. On top of that, I really could not stand Chris Pratt's character. I don't know if it's a case of the character is poorly written or if Chris Pratt is just a terrible voice actor, but every time his character did something, I was like, boy, I want this character to shut the fuck up. He was just insufferable. And I just could not get into the movie because I just couldn't stand him. Also, I got really sick of like them just like, ah, oh, there's a pair of pants walking around. I don't know. I didn't like it. I did not like Onward.
Yeah, I wish Brad was here because he loved Chris Pratt in this movie, I think, in one of the water coolers. It really felt like they wanted Jack Black for the role and they couldn't get him, so they got Chris Pratt.
Yeah, it really felt like they were basing that on like Jack Black's Tenacious D character, and they like thought, well, Chris Pratt's a bigger star now, so let's get him. But I just don't think he's a good voice actor, so I just didn't care for his character.
HT, what did you think of Onward?
I was much warmer to this movie than Chris, but I will say it's probably not one of my favorite Pixars. I'd say it's probably like mid-tier, maybe upper mid-tier Pixar for me. I enjoyed the simplicity of this film, actually. I liked how straightforward it was. I thought at some points, though, it did feel disjointed, especially in the elements of its more rich world-building part and the simple brotherly story, the sibling story between Chris Pratt and Tom Holland's character. And I was really turned off by the character designs and just general look of this film before I even watched it. I can't say that I liked it any more while watching it, but I did really enjoy the emotional crux of this movie, especially in, you know, that sibling relationship. And I quite liked how it was in contrast to the more simplistic narrative of the movie, that relationship was a little bit more, had a little bit more depth and complexity to it than I anticipated. I like the idea of, like, spoilers, like the older brother kind of being the one who raised the younger brother, and that kind of, that added another depth to this movie that I didn't actually anticipate. And I quite like that. I felt like it was almost an evolution in terms of how Pixar treats its emotional narratives a little bit, so that we've been seeing, especially with, you know, Toy Story 4, which was an okay movie but had a really interesting emotional through line. So I liked it. I can't say it's one of my favorite Pixars, but I enjoyed it more than I thought I would. I think you said this, Peter, back when you were first talking about it, that there's kind of it feels like there's two movies in here.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed one movie much more than I enjoyed the other. Like, I enjoyed the story of the brothers a lot more than like the actual world and the anachronisms.
Which is so strange because I think that world is such a great idea that, you know, there used to be magic and it got replaced by technology, but it feels like they never follow
like
up on
thought.
Yeah, they never follow up on that in any way. Like, no, I guess this is it's not really a spoiler, but like, you expect when you establish that like by the end of the movie, the world's gonna realize that the world used to be magical, and like, it doesn't become, it's not about that at all. Like, it really does feel like two different ideas that like they had. This feels, I like this movie more than Chris. I think I'm in the middle of you guys. It feels like this was like, you know how Pixar remakes their movie like five times during the development? This feels like it's like the third time and they haven't gotten to the five, you know, the like the polished fifth draft of the movie. That's what it feels like.
Yeah, I can see that too.
Yeah. What have I been watching? Oh, last week, Ben, I guess I'm following Ben. Everything he's recommending, I'm just like going and watching. but I went watched Happy Death Day, which I don't know why I didn't watch this sooner, because I love movies that have like time loops and that whole thing, like Groundhog Day. I have been going to Halloween Horror Nights for years, and I've experienced like Happy Death Day in a variety of different mazes there, and you know, the baby faced head things, masks, were always kind of interesting and made me be interested. I'm not sure why I didn't watch it. I don't know. But now it's streaming on HBO and I gave it a chance, and it's good. It's really good. I will say in the beginning, I wasn't as into it because the main character is very unlikable at first and very stupid. And I know that's the point, and I know that's where we get to. Like, you need to have an arc for this character, but like, I feel like she was unlikable to a degree that like it was off-putting. But you need to see glimpses of like the person that she could be in the beginning to, I don't know. That would be my one criticism. I didn't anticipate this to that it was going to be so much of a comedy. Like, I feel like it's almost at times more of a comedy than a horror movie. I love that it's kind of like the Scream style mystery of, you know, who is the person under the mask? And she's reliving this one day, the day that she dies, to find out who it is. But at the same time, like, one of the times when she's getting killed, why doesn't she just like pull off the guy's mask? Would have been easy. She could have found out that. The baby mask is creepy. I'm excited to watch the sequel because I know you guys, like Chris was saying, that the sequel is even better than the first.
Oh yeah, I like both of these, but the sequel I like more. The sequel is crazier and sharper and funnier and like surprisingly emotional. Like, it made me cry at one point when I first saw it. So the sequel I really recommend.
I think you especially will really like the sequel, Peter, because it has a much more sci-fi comedy bent. So it's definitely something I feel like appeals to you.
Well, I'm excited. Okay.
Peter, since we're talking about this really quick, I actually watched Happy Death Day to you. Didn't really have much to say about it aside from everything that everybody here just said, including like what Chris said, which is that I actually it made me cry at one point, and I was totally not expecting that from a sequel to a horror movie that has sort of a goofy like time loop premise. So I was very surprised by how well executed the sequel was and how much bigger and sort of crazier and funnier it is. And I think it's just a huge, huge improvement over the first one, which I liked a lot as it was. So I think I echo everybody's comments that I think you're really going to enjoy that.
Well, very cool. I also watched this past week, David Blaine had a new TV special called David Blaine, The Magic Way. And I actually don't know what the story is behind this TV special. David Blaine doesn't do that many TV specials. Like, he usually does a TV special like every, like, I guess the last few years he's been doing it like every 2 years or something like that. But before that, like, there was periods of like 4 or 5 years he didn't do a special. So it was rare to get a David Blaine magic special on TV. And this special feels like it was put together very quickly. It was announced like a week and a half ago or 2 weeks ago that it was going to be on ABC. And like, it feels like it was the result of this pandemic that kind of put this together in some way. I don't know if he was like in the middle of making a special and then it kind of had to evolve into something else. And then ABC was like, we have a spot that we need to like fill something with. But the special starts off with showing David Blaine doing magic over FaceTime. He's doing magic over FaceTime to the healthcare workers who are working in New York City and places around the world during this time, which is really strange because like they have like a deck of cards and they're shuffling and he's telling them to do stuff. The special really is about the power of close-up magic and how it can, you know, entertainment can heal us in these kind of times. It's interesting too because he, in recent years, David Blaine started off as a magician who walked the streets and would do magic on the streets to people. And it was all about he as a magician changed it from it being about the magic and the magician to it being about the reactions. It's all about the people's reactions. It's all about the guy running away, yelling no, no, no. It's about that, and also, you know, him acting, him possibly having like real power, like, you know, teasing that it could be, is it real? Like, is this a trick or is this like a real thing? Is he really sticking a skewer through his hand or is that like a gimmick? It's like the question of those things. In recent years, his specials have come to be more about him doing magic for celebrities, which is strange. And in the special, there's a couple times where he's doing magic for like different celebrities. And it almost feels like it was filmed at someone's party, someone's Hollywood party on like an iPhone. Like he had a friend like, oh, tape this. I'll film this and maybe we could put this into a special or something. So it's like very like these impromptu kind of stuff for the most part. And like that FaceTime stuff. And it's fun to see him. It really doesn't feel like there were anything like any hugely new invented tricks here. He's doing a lot of like his classics, the stuff that you saw in his first two specials. But it's interesting to, at least from a magician point of view and looking at magic as art, seeing how the tricks that he did in his original specials have evolved and are now, found ways to make them more personal. He's had he'll do a trick and someone, you know, he's shuffling face down and face up cards and he restores the deck. And originally it was he'd restore the deck and it would be the card they picked was the only card that's not face down. But now it's like, oh, it's the guy's like PIN code on his iPhone. And it's more interesting in that way. I think you could probably find this on YouTube if you're interested. I wouldn't say this is like a top tier David Blaine special. I would say like two specials ago, the Real or Magic special, I think was one of his best. But it was really enjoyable. And oh, it ends with this whole segment, like a 10-minute segment of him and his daughter. It's very heartfelt. His daughter's trying to learn magic, and that I think is probably the best segment of the whole thing. So that is David Blaine, The Magic Way. You can find it on ABC, or maybe you can find it on YouTube or something like that. A couple weeks back, I watched a screener of the first 5 episodes of Bosch season 6. This is a show that's on Amazon, which I know no one else on this podcast watches. Although I think I keep on saying this, but I think Ben would enjoy the first couple seasons of Bosch because it's like a hard boiled like detective story.
I am going to watch it one day. Yeah. I promise you that.
Being dads. You don't have kids.
It's so weird. It's such a weird show because I feel like you look at a billboard, you look at a poster, you even look at a trailer for Bosch, it doesn't seem appealing in any way. But it is actually a pretty good show. And like the first couple seasons are good because I believe it's an adaptation of a like novel, of a couple novels. And the first couple seasons are kind of more self-contained and can be almost watched as like a 10-hour movie. Like a detective movie. Sure, there is some backstory of him like kind of investigating what happened to his mom, and that through line kind of goes throughout the seasons. I would say the downfall to season 6 of Bosch is that it has kind of reached a level of serial storytelling where I feel like you could jump into season 3 and still understand everything. Season 6, you jump in, like, it has so much stuff that's been established in this world. It takes place in LA, and there's, like, the character that's running for mayor, and there's, like, all this stuff going on that, like, isn't really, like, so simple. And this season's also weird. It has reached it begins with a 24-level threat of and how it would really go down of someone having some radioactive material in LA. And it's kind of not what you expect from Bosch. I did want to ask Ben this because I was watching the first episode of this and Bosch goes to interview a victim, a wife whose husband has been killed and murdered, right? And he is interviewing the victim, getting, like, you know, finding out what happened. Like, she had been tied up and stuff like that. And the victim was giving such a bad acting job that I was wondering, like, is this intentional for us to suspect the wife, or is she just a bad actress? And like, you know, the characters on screen don't address it like I don't believe her or something like that. Has that ever happened in a mystery story for you, Ben?
That somebody has been purposefully bad and like as a manner of deception, and then you find out later, like, oh, this character is actually different than.
Well, I don't want to say if she's been purposely bad or not, or I'm not even going to say if I know if she's been purposely bad or not. But I'm just wondering, like, have you ever gone into a story and been like, that performance is really, like, weak? Like, but am I supposed to think it's, like, like while you're watching it, have you ever encountered that where you're, like, questioning, like, is this intentional or is this, like, just a bad performance?
Yes. What the hell is the name of, and I'm sure somebody here can help me out, the name of the, I want to say it's called Heist? David Mamet, the 2001 movie.
I'm Are you going to say sure... Rebecca Pigeon? Because I'm going to fight you on this.
No, I thought it was, God, who, there's somebody in a movie like that. Is it Edward Norton? Somebody
Oh, that's supporting... you're thinking of The Score with Robert De Niro.
Yes. That's the one. Edward Norton has a supporting role in that movie. And I was like, what on earth is this choice? And then, events transpire and it's like, sort of like, oh, okay. I guess I understand this a little bit better now. That's the only one off the top of my head I can think of.
Yeah. It was just strange because it's not also like they walk away from the interview and like Bosch is like, something's up with her. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. If they said that, then I'd be like, oh, maybe this is intentional. But Bosch season 6, I'm not sure if I recommend it unless you've seen the first 5 seasons and liked it, but I'm still in, and I'm gonna watch the final 5 episodes whenever I get access to those.
Peter, I have a Bosch question for you.
Yeah.
I have not watched Bosch. I've not read any of the books it's based on.
Yeah.
But I do know that writer Michael Connelly, the novelist, in the universe that he creates within his books, he has 2 ongoing series. His character, the Lincoln lawyer, who Matthew McConaughey played in a film adaptation, is the half-brother of Bosch, and they occasionally cross over in each other's novels. Has the Lincoln lawyer shown up in Bosch in any capacity?
Not that I know of. Not that I remember. Huh.
There's not like a part where like a Lincoln drives by and Bosch winks at the camera. Like, that's my brother.
I was reading an article with Michael Connelly when I was writing up the most recent trailer for Bosch season 6, Jacob, and he mentioned that whatever movie studio produced The Lincoln Lawyer, I want to say it's like CBS Films or something, has the rights to that character, the Mickey, whatever his name is, character. So I don't think that he's been able to appear in the Bosch verse.
I want the Michael Connelly cinematic universe, the MCCU, guys. Bring it on.
Well, it seems like it's not going to happen, Jacob. So,
look, I will watch Bosch if they bring in the Lincoln Lawyer. Lincoln Lawyer is a good movie. I like that movie.
Only if they name him Lincoln Lawyer. Mr. Lawyer is my name.
Okay. What else have I been watching? I also watched the last episode of Better Call Saul that aired this week, and it was awesome. I don't really want to spoil too much of it. I know, Vince Gilligan, who hasn't really been involved in the writer's room this season, he came and directed this episode, and it's just so good. It is probably one of the best episodes of this series, and I highly recommend if you aren't watching this season. Well, you know, if you aren't watching the show, watch the show. But if for some reason you have a bunch of these on your DVR and you haven't gotten to the season, you got to catch up because this is so good. Chris, I know you also watch the show, right?
Yes, and this is like the best episode, not just of this show. I think it's up there with like all the best episodes of both this show and Breaking Bad. Like, this is up there with like Ozymandias and stuff like that. It was such a good episode. It blew me away. I was not expecting, even though I love this show, I was not expecting how great this episode was. So I know there are people out there who have yet to start Better Call Saul, and I implore you, please check it out because it is such a great show. I honestly think it's like the best show on TV right now.
Yeah, no, I agree with you there. And it's also interesting, I was listening to the Better Call Saul podcast, which they have, which is a great podcast. It's not a great produced podcast. It's a bunch of people involved in the show sitting around talking about the making. And it's a lot of like, you know, patting each other in the back, which is kind of annoying. But aside from that, like, you get like a really good glimpse into the making of a show and how, you know, the work of what a showrunner does. And, you know, even they'll have like the editor, they'll have the actors. But this week on the episode, I guess it's fair to say that this episode, this last week's episode, takes place mostly out in the desert, kind of like, you know, like the desert that, like, we've seen, you know, in Albuquerque from in Breaking Bad and stuff like that. What I didn't know is this was filmed during the summer, which is like intense heats in Albuquerque. Like, they didn't have a choice because, you know, if it was a movie, you'd schedule the filming to happen like later on. But like, this was in the middle of the season, or, you know, the very end of the season. It's not like they can delay the filming. They have to shoot this thing in the middle of the desert with, you know, the main actors like on screen almost every single shot. And Vince Gilligan said it was like the hardest thing he had to ever film in his life. So yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, that's all I've been watching. Chris, what have you been watching?
In addition to the things I already mentioned, I also watched Killing Eve season 3, which premieres this week, and it premieres on Sunday, and my review actually just went up today. And it's good. If you like this show, you're still going to like this season. I know a lot of people were kind of not in love with season 2. I thought it was good. It's not as good as the first season, but I thought it was good. But a lot of people were angry, especially at the way the second season ended. But so if you were angry about that, I don't know if you're going to want to stick with the show, because it's not like this season is like changing course. But if you're still in on this show, you're gonna continue to like it. I love this show. So again, it's not as great as season one. Phoebe Waller-Bridge was like directly involved and producing it and writing it, and she actually left the show after season one, and you can tell she's not involved anymore, because it doesn't have like as sharp writing as it did in season one. But I still think it's a worthwhile show, and that premieres on Sunday, like I said.
Jacob, you've been watching like more things in the last week than I think I have for the last 6 months.
Yeah, I have. It was a big painting week for me, miniature painting. So I would set up shop in front of the TV, and I would paint while we watch things. So we started things off with a movie that has been discussed on this podcast a few times already, so I'll be brief. The Mask of Zorro. Great movie. Like, it's one of those movies where, you know, 20-some-odd years ago, it was like, oh, a really fun popcorn flick, but age has, you know, reveal that, oh, this is actually a great movie, not just a fun movie. Time does that to blockbusters sometimes. It allows us to see the filmmaking beyond, you know, the mass appeal. And it's just such a wonderful piece of entertainment, beautifully executed. Martin Campbell, such an up-and-down career. I mean, the same guy who made this and GoldenEye and Casino Royale also made Green Lantern. It's just baffling. But when he's on, he's on. And Mask of Zorro is just, it's just old-fashioned swashbuckler. It's sexy, it's funny, it's exciting. It's smart. It's just a complete package. So we decided to follow Mask of Zorro with another swashbuckler, and that is 2002's The Count of Monte Cristo, based on the Alexandre Dumas novel. And I read the book in high school, and I loved it. And my wife had seen the movie in high school and loved it, so we decided to finally watch the movie together. And it's kind of like someone said, yeah, this book about revenge needs to have action. So even though it follows the basic beats of the novel, it adds lots and lots of sword fights, which, you know, in the book, the main character is sent to prison for crime he didn't commit, escapes, and systematically gets revenge on the people who put him there by destroying their lives financially, emotionally, just wrecks them in every possible way, but, you know, doesn't actually sword fight them. And in this one, he sword fights all of them.
Jacob, do you remember the tagline for this movie? Because it's burned into my brain because I love it so much.
What is it?
The tagline is, I think it came out in the summer, so it was like, this summer, count on revenge.
Anyway, this is directed by Kevin Reynolds, who did Waterworld and Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. It's a goofy movie. It's fun. It's the goofiest way you could have adapted this material, but I had a good time with it. Young Jim Caviezel is the lead. A really over-the-top Guy Pearce plays the main villain. Just like sniveling, rotten teeth, just like just like the worst possible guy imaginable. And baby Henry Cavill, like Henry Cavill, like shrunk to like 1/3 of his modern size is in this. And every time Henry Cavill showed up, even though he's perfectly fine, I couldn't stop laughing because he's so tiny. You can fit Henry Cavill in your pocket in this movie. It reminds me of seeing Tom Hardy in Star Trek Nemesis, where like his Tom Hardy can fit in your pocket for the one time only. So it just like, it just cracked me up to see Henry Cavill so tiny. HG, have you seen this movie? I need to know your opinion on tiny Henry Cavill.
I haven't seen this movie because when it came out, I was reading the book at the time and my parents had rented the movie and I was excited to watch the movie and kind of compare it to the book. But my parents would not let me watch the movie until I finished the book and I was very upset by that. So I never actually saw this movie. I will say about tiny Henry Cavill, he also shows up in Stardust at the beginning of the film and is also very tiny.
Yeah, it is surreal. It's like the Captain America, Steve Rogers before the serum and Civil War. Sorry, First Avenger. It's just like that, but it's Henry Cavill. It's like a giant head in his tiny body, even though it's his real body. It cracked me up every single time he was on screen. I'm sorry, Henry Cavill. You're a very attractive man now. Moving on, Kong Skull Island was on TV, so we watched it with commercials, which is weirdly relaxing. I feel like when a movie has commercials, you're allowed to, like, you know, chit-chat on breaks, and, like, get up, go get a snack. There's something like, I miss about that in the age of streaming, of being able to, like, every 15 minutes, like, stretch out and chat about the movie so far and, you know, check your email. There's something very relaxing about commercials at the right time, the right situation. And Kong Skull Island, it's good. I still like the movie. It's a lot of fun. It's a big, silly monster mash, far more successful at what it wants to do than the Godzilla sequel. And speaking of Godzilla, the Gareth Edwards Godzilla played directly after it on TV, so we watched that too. And I'm still a big fan of this movie. I know Aaron Taylor Johnson's snooze, but I love how Edwards films this movie. And I just love how it's a horror film, first and foremost. Love how it hides Godzilla. I love that it's a disaster film. It's about, you know, human reacting to something that they can't stop. I mean, the movie is really about a godlike beings wrecking the earth and humankind reacting to it as opposed to like being involved in it. And it's a perspective that I really find terrifying and appreciate a lot. And we followed up with National Treasure, which is, God, that movie's fun. Another movie like Mask of Zorro that was like a big hit at the time, a big populist, you know, film made for a wide audience that time has revealed is actually really, really genuinely good. I don't like the sequel as much, but the first one holds up so well. And Nicolas Cage is having a lot of fun. It's a right balance of silly Cage and serious Cage. And I like that's PG. I like that's a family film that still feels adventurous and action-packed. We're all team National Treasure here, right? Everybody likes National Treasure on this podcast, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't like National Treasure 2, but yeah. I love the first one.
Yeah, the sequel's not as good, but the first one's awesome.
All right, so we followed it up naturally with Raiders of the Lost Ark, the perfect double feature with National Treasure. I know I talked about Indiana Jones and Last Crusade last week. Raiders, it's also on Netflix, like Last Crusade, and it's a masterpiece. I don't need to say anything else but Raiders of the friggin' Lost Ark. It's a pitch-perfect movie. It's my top 10 of all time. It's an unmatched movie. It's peerless. But we decided to follow it up with another Spielberg movie, Minority Report, speaking of Chris's 21st Century column, also streaming on Netflix. Not a report, not as good as Raiders of the Lost Ark, but I still like it a lot. I think there's some contrivances to the script. The last stretch kind of bends over backwards to give a sad story a happy ending. And it really does kind of soften the edges of the Philip K. Dick short story on which it's based. But no one shoots action like Spielberg. It's an exciting movie. And the futurism aspects, he famously did a lot of research and brought on a lot of people to like envision what a future would look like. And so much of this movie came to pass in ways both subtle and not so subtle. Minority Report mostly holds up. I really like Minority Report. Next up, a Shudder original called The Room. This is not the Tommy Wiseau The Room. This is a small, I think, Belgian horror movie starring Olga Kurylenko. It's about a couple who move into an old house and find a room with a strange contraption in it that can grant any wish that they want. And since this is a Shudder original, the Shudder being the horror streaming service, things go very poorly for them as they start making the wrong kinds of wishes. And I found this to be a really engaging movie, you know, far from perfect, you know, rough around the edges. But it takes the idea of wishes gone wrong and in a really unique direction. I feel like so many of these types of horror movies are like essentially the monkey paw on a different scale. Uh-oh, your wish is in reverse. Things go wrong. Whereas The Room manages to make an evil horror movie, wish gone wrong movie that is not monkey paw all over again. And I won't say any more because the wishes they make come back to haunt them in a way that genuinely surprised me. Chris, have you seen The Room yet?
I haven't. I keep seeing it on Shudder, but based on what you said, I'll probably check it out now because I wasn't sure if it was any good or not.
Yeah, I like it a lot. I'm curious to hear what you think. They need to change name, though. Talking about The Room, when it's already a more famous movie called The Room, is a pain in the butt.
Right.
All right, Disney Plus. I hit Disney Plus up. Ratatouille, guys, top two Pixar for me, probably right behind Up or Inside Out. It's a great movie. WALL-E. Did you know WALL-E is a movie about human beings flee into isolation with their screens after a bumbling businessman and his government fails to respond to a disaster? It's good quarantine viewing, guys. anyway, WALL-E's good.
The way you put it, Jacob, makes me feel like I would get mad and I would start hating a Pixar movie I love. So I don't want to do that.
Followed up with Aladdin, the 1992 version, holds up for me for the most part. It's weird now because as brilliant as Robin Williams is as the genie, his jokes ensure that it's one of the very few Disney movies that will never be timeless, unless Rodney Dangerfield impressions are timeless 50 years from now. but I think it's a fun movie. I like it quite a bit. Naturally followed up with Moana, which is Aladdin remade into Polynesian Islands, but I like Moana more than Aladdin actually. And, Moana is one of those movies I can watch over and over again. It's a delightful thing. The perfect mixture of all the Disney elements I love so much. Finally, Disney Plus, Captain Marvel. I like it. It's good. Like, it's fun. Tries a little too hard at times, but I'd say, you know, lower the mid-tier Marvel. But I still think Captain Marvel is a perfectly fine time, especially since you can, like, stream it while you paint miniatures and not pay attention to it at all times. finally, New Girl. I'm in season three now. Season three... Excuse me, I'm talking a lot. HD, season 3 of New Girl is my favorite one so far. Am I correct in that assumption? Is that the common thing amongst fans?
Oh, for sure. Season 3 is when it really hits its stride because they tone down Zooey Deschanel's character's quirkiness and they tone up everyone else's real oddball antics, especially once they unleash Lamorne Morris. He's hilarious as Winston, and he's so funny and really the scene stealer of the show, like from, you know, season 2, season 3 onward. And of course Jake Johnson and his fantastic facial expressions. I'm really enjoying that. I really like that you're enjoying it, and I hope that you're going to continue enjoying it.
We just met Ferguson the cat, and Lamorne Morris is gone insane. It's such an incredible performance. I love that they realized that his strengths as an actor were just to let him go become a lunatic, and this leaned into it. It's so good.
Yes.
Well, that's it for me. I need to go drink some water.
Okay. I guess, HT, it's your turn. What have you been watching?
I watched a thriller called The Platform. This debuted on Netflix, I think, last week. It's a Spanish horror thriller sci-fi film set in this sort of dystopian type of prison in which every cell is built vertically. And in the cell, which only houses two cellmates, there is a giant hole in the middle through which a platform full of food, a feast of food, lowers for each level. And there are hundreds of levels in this prison. So at the top, the prisoners receive the most food, and it's like this incredible banquet. And as the platform gets lowered and lowered, less food is left until the there's absolutely nothing left for the bottom floors, who are left to starve to death and or engage in cannibalism. This is a really, really brutal and bleak film that, to the point that halfway through I considered turning it off just because it got so grotesque and so disturbing. But I powered through, and it is really effective in its very unsubtle criticism of, you know, capitalism and the hierarchical nature of such. Though I will say I feel like Snowpiercer did it a little bit more elegantly. But it does its job, and I will recommend it only if you are not weak of stomach, because it is quite a disturbing film to watch. Has anyone else seen The Platform?
Everyone was talking about it at Fantastic Fest, but I did not see it. But I heard it's wild.
Yeah, I'm annoyed. Someone talked me out of it at the fest, saying it was terrible. Then immediately after I missed the last screening, everybody told me I should have seen it. And now everybody's raving about it. And I'm so mad.
I think Jacob and Chris will like this movie. A lot of elements just really turn me off, but it does get incredibly wild and insane. I think that some of the more unsettled elements too are just kind of a little bit too on the nose. But
is there anything involving like animal? That's like my
yes, there is actually.
All right, then I won't be watching it. Never mind.
Yeah, there's a dog. I won't say anything more.
All right, yeah, I will definitely not watch this then. Thank you for telling me.
You're welcome. I also watched Moonstruck for the first time, which I really, really enjoyed. This is a film that I had been meaning to see for a while. This is the romantic comedy starring Cher and Nicolas Cage. It's streaming currently on Amazon Prime. And I had seen it gone, I think part of it went viral for a little bit on Twitter because of Nicolas Cage's line where he talks about how bread is his life. And so I just kind of used that excuse to, or like I was inspired by that to finally watch it. And I really, really enjoyed this film. It's so heightened and fun and funny. And everyone speaks either in riddles or in poetry, and they all speak with really aggressive Italian gesturing. It's the most hilariously stereotypical Italian film I've ever seen. And Cher and Nicolas Cage are fantastic and have such really like searing chemistry. And Nicolas Cage is just like really, really attractive in this film. I have to say, like, I've always kind of wavered on whether Nicolas Cage is attractive or not. I've always liked him as an actor. I think that he's great in every film that he does. But in this movie was the first time where I felt really, really attracted to him. And yeah, he just gives off this really physical and primal performance. And it's almost hilarious how straightforward he is. My roommate and I, as we were watching together, kept just repeating his lines where he'd say like, "Oh, I like your hair," in this hilarious just like deep voice. And I have to say too that this is kind of just my own way of thinking. It doesn't have anything to do with the movie, but it made me realize why everyone likes Adam Driver so much. Nicolas Cage has kind of the same energy that Adam Driver does in a lot of his films. It's kind of awkward, I don't know, chemistry to him. And I have to say, I kind of understand now why people love Adam Driver. But yeah, Nicolas Cage is excellent in this, as is Cher. And I absolutely love this movie. That's Moonstruck. The last thing I did was I rewatched Rear Window. So it was kind of inspired by me going on my roof and just creepily staring at all the windows of my neighboring buildings around me. And my roommate had never seen Rear Window before, so we decided to watch it. And it's, you know, perfect film. One of my favorite Hitchcocks. I love how tight and taut it is. And the performances by James Stewart and by Grace Kelly, who I think is the platonic ideal of the Hitchcock blonde in this film. And yeah, it's my... I watched this movie like two or three times already, but every time I absolutely adore it. So Rear Window, that is it streaming anywhere? Where did I watch it?
I was going to say, do you own this or is this streaming? Because I actually had, I think I inspired by you. I was like, man, I need to rewatch Rear Window. And then I don't think I could find it streaming anywhere. I didn't know if you had it on DVD.
I rented it on Amazon. I remember now.
Okay.
Yeah. So you can rent it, but it's not streaming anywhere as of now.
Yeah, it looks like it's like $4 on Amazon or YouTube or Google or iTunes to rent it. So yeah, Ben, what have you been watching?
So in addition to Happy Death Day to You, I watched The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, which is written and directed by Powell and Pressburger. This came out in 1943. It is a romantic war drama starring Roger Livesey, I think that's how you pronounce his last name, and Deborah Kerr. She plays multiple roles in the movie. Roger Livesey, man, he is... I don't really know much about him as an actor, but he has been very impressive in everything that I've seen him in. And I guess he worked with the Archers a lot back in the day. That's the nickname of Powell and Pressburger. This movie is really, really good. It's about a general who is, or I guess he's just a soldier to start out with, and he fights. It takes place over the course of like I think 40 years or so, and it tracks him and his progression as he just fights through these different skirmishes, and it sort of tracks his love life, and he has this he fights a duel with a German soldier, and they end up becoming friends. And the movie, I really found it to be like shockingly relevant to our current political situation, because the main character is this aging soldier general character who grew up in this older era of war. And the movie is sort of about how important it is for him to adapt with the times and fight the enemy with current methods, instead of expecting archaic tactics to just simply work over and over again because they've worked in the past. And I cannot think of a more relevant I guess parallel to like our current politics and how Democrats and Republicans are shaping the narrative of America right now. You can decide which side needs to update its tactics. I'm not going to, you know, go on a diatribe here or anything. But yeah, anyway, Jacob, this seems like one that you would have seen, right?
Absolutely. Powell and Pressburger are two of the best filmmakers of all time. Matter of Life and Death's my second favorite film of all time. But Red Shoes, Black Narcissus. This doesn't get talked about as much as with other films, and it's just as good. If I remember correctly, it's a bit longer than those. Maybe that's why people stay away from it, or because the title feels a little bit silly from the outside. But yeah, if you have not looked into the filmography of Powell and Pressburger, most of it's on Criterion Channel or a Criterion Disc at this point. These guys are just incredible, and their movies are so beautiful. Like the most beautifully shot films from this era, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. I actually had this in my queue for a long time, but sort of stayed away from it because I thought the title was a little silly. But there's not even a character named Colonel Blimp in the movie at all. So if that's the only thing that's holding you back, then don't hold back. Watch this movie. It is available on the Criterion Channel, which is where I streamed it. So that's The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp. And then I also had a Toshiro Mifune marathon. I'm not sure if that's exactly how you pronounce his name. I apologize if it's not. This guy worked with Akira Kurosawa a ton of times. I've talked a couple times about some of the movies that I've seen of their collaborations. Yojimbo recently, some other ones. But I think last week would have marked the 100th birthday of Mifune. And so also on the Criterion channel, they have a lot of their collaborations streaming right now. So I watched Drunken Angel, which was the first time that they worked together out of the 16 total movies that they made together. Drunken Angel is very good. It also stars Takashi Shimura, and he plays this alcoholic doctor, and Mifune plays this really like low rent gangster in Japan. And it's really interesting to see what Japan looked like in 1948. It sort of has like a small town feel to it versus like the, you know, whatever megalopolis or whatever term is that it is now. And this movie, you know, like a lot of great film noirs, it's sort of about this underlying sickness in society. It's a sort of about how people who do awful things like steal from veterans on their way home from war, and how these like terrible things can drive otherwise good people to do terrible things of their own. And there's this really stifling feeling to the movie where it sometimes feels like people can barely breathe because of the situations they face and the hardships that are facing them. And I feel like the movie reflects that, sort of physicalizes that a little bit with this heat wave that's always drenching the characters in sweat. This is such a sweaty movie in that way. It's like one of the hottest, like most unpleasant movies to watch because it just makes you feel really hot. So maybe it's a good movie to watch in winter if you're freezing cold and cooped up in an apartment or something like that. But anyway, yeah, that's called Drunken Angel. Have any of you seen this by any chance?
I've seen all the films you're about to talk about. They're all great. The second one, though, you're about to mention is my favorite of the bunch.
Yeah, so Stray Dog is, this one I think is even sweatier than Drunken Angel. This one's super sweaty, actually. It's based a little bit, or at least was inspired by The Naked City, which is an American film noir movie that came out about a year beforehand. This one came out in 1949. It also stars those same actors, Mifune and Shimura, and was directed by Kurosawa. And it's basically about this rookie police officer who has his, police-issued gun stolen from him on a bus during the middle of a heat wave. And the whole movie is just this like police procedural where he just hunts down clue after clue after clue and trying to find out what the hell happened to this gun. And people start committing murders with the gun. So he is just racked by guilt. And Mifune is so solid in this movie. Wikipedia says it's like a precursor to the buddy cop film genre that would sort of blow up, you know, whatever, 30 years later, which I didn't really realize. But I guess looking back on it through, you know, with that lens, it makes a lot of sense, because a lot of those sort of tropes and stuff are, if not established, then at least put to use, utilized in this movie. So, Jacob, sounds like you're a big fan of this one.
I'm a huge fan, because one, it's an incredibly entertaining noir with an engaging mystery. But it's an amazing double feature with, of all things, 1954's Godzilla, because they're both films made in Japan by Japanese filmmakers in the immediate aftermath of World War II that deal with the fallout of what it was like to live in Japan, you know, after two nukes are dropped on you, after you lost a world war. And even though this film is a fun cop movie, it is very much about, you know, how does a civilization rebuild itself after that, after Nagasaki and Hiroshima? How does your civilization that's existed for thousands of years continue when you're now being occupied by American forces who are essentially systematically changing your government and your society? Mm-hmm. And to see a Japanese filmmaker grapple with this through entertainment, both in this and, except of all things, Godzilla, just proves that, like, it's such a valuable cultural artifact from this era of Japanese art. And I think it's a fascinating movie.
Yeah, it's really, really enjoyable. That one is also on Criterion Channel, as is Sanjuro, which is the, I guess, quasi-sequel. I guess it was basically, it came out after Yojimbo, I think the year after. And it was originally supposed to be another movie, but they sort of reworked it to include Mifune's character, this sort of wandering Ronin character from Yojimbo, as the main character of this movie. So it sort of reminds me of like Die Hard with a Vengeance or something like that, where, you know, that's another film that was like famously changed to incorporate Bruce Willis's John McClane. I'm not sure if this is a popular opinion or not, but I think I like Sanjuro more than Yojimbo. I know Yojimbo is like the more influential movie, and it was remade a couple times as Westerns, and is like the one that I think is generally held in higher esteem. But for me, Sanjuro is a lot funnier, and the deception in the movie is a lot more interesting to me. It's basically about the samurai who wanders into a town, and he discovers that there's this group of clansmen who are about to get killed because one of their uncles has been framed and imprisoned by this superintendent of the area, who is this corrupt sort of politician guy, and they're about to just wander in and get obliterated by the opposing army. And he decides to help them. And the humor in the movie comes with them like wanting to rush into situations and just being really stupid about everything, and him just being like, calm down, you idiots. Here's what's happening. Here's the way that this is going to work. And he's such like a swaggering anti-hero in this. So yeah, if you're looking for a really good Mifune performance, I would say watch Sanjuro, which again is on Criterion Channel right now.
Ben, have you seen High and Low?
I have not. I actually have that next up in my queue. So I'm looking forward to checking that one out.
Yeah, I think the fact that the same actor, Toshiro Mifune, could star as a rookie cop in Stray Dog, a badass samurai in Sanjuro, and then a middle-aged businessman whose child is kidnapped in High and Low, the range of this guy, just incredible. There's never been another actor like him. I can't think of a modern equivalent to him. I can't.
Yeah, once I get through his whole filmography, which is something that I'm greatly enjoying, by the way, because I don't think I've come across a dud from him and Kurosawa yet. I'm looking forward to seeing if I can come up with a modern comparison myself, because I've sort of been thinking about the same thing. Like, I've just been very impressed with his range so far and what I've seen, and it looks like I've a long way to go. I've sort of barely touched the surface here.
Okay, let's move on to what we've been eating. Since Brad isn't here, HG's going to tell us about what she's been eating this week.
Yes, it's not that exciting as Brad's many collection of snacks, but I've been cooking, you know, and I have been updating my adventures in cooking on my Instagram stories. And this week, I tried frying tofu for the first time. This is something that I've been kind of hyping myself up to do for the past 2 weeks, and I finally just bit the bullet and did it. I've been very scared of frying things because the idea of hot oil splashing around is just very scary to me. And I only fried something once before, and it went very wrong because I don't have a kitchen thermometer, so I didn't know how to measure whether the oil was ready or not. And when I last time I fried something, it was a pork cutlet. I was trying to make katsu curry, which is a Japanese curry with a pork cutlet, and my pork cutlet got burned, and I was very sad. But this time, I fried tofu. Nothing got burned, nothing caught on fire, and it was delicious. So I made like this Vietnamese, sort of a classic Vietnamese dinner spread with thịt dang, which I've talked about making before. It's kind of caramelized ground pork and the fried tofu with this sort of scallion oil fish sauce on top and cabbage with this sort of egg, hard-boiled egg sauce. Don't know all the names in Vietnamese, unfortunately. I think it's whether like there's a dish. Yeah, there are specific dishes. It's kind of things I grew up eating. So I was really excited about nothing catching on fire when I fried tofu. This is not a dig at Chris, by the way. I don't mean to, this is just something that happened, and I just am very grateful that like everything went well and I didn't die and burn. So yay.
Well, it's not like you're frying a turkey in like a garbage can or whatever. Whatever that goes wrong is like crazy.
Yes.
But I'm always watching your Instagram stories. And I'm like drooling at all the like food that you're making. It all looks so good. And what did you, caramelized the like pork in some kind of like, I forget what you said, some kind of sauce?
Yes. So the caramelized ground pork is just, it's very simple. You just, it's just shallots, garlic, and ground pork that you kind of press, like, you know, chop up or not chop up, but, you know, mix up with your spoon, with the wooden spoon. And it's soy sauce and there's some like sugar in there, dark soy sauce. Yeah, it's very simple. Yeah. Oh, some fish sauce, too. So it's just it's a simple thing.
Very cool. Let's move on to what we've been playing. Jacob, you are the only person playing this week. What have you been playing?
Peter, I played about 100 hours of The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild. And I beat it.
Wow. Congrats.
It's one of those games where simultaneously stressful and relaxing because there's so much to do at all times. Your list of quests grows and grows and grows. But the game's world is so idyllic at times and so oddly peaceful that there's like a relaxation to exploring it. I mean, so many open world video games, even ones I enjoy, like Grand Theft Auto 5 or Red Dead Redemption 2, are so full of events and side quests and chaos. It's like everywhere you go, crazy things are happening. Whereas in Breath of the Wild, you can be wandering around, you know, the Kingdom of Hyrule for 15 minutes, not see an enemy, not encounter any danger, just climb mountains, collect berries. And there's something relaxing about the emptiness. There's something beautiful and lonely about it. And I mean, there's plenty of action. And of course, like all Zelda games, you storm a castle and you fight Ganon at the end. But there's still a lot more to do. There's a ton of side quests I left unfinished if I want to go back. There's a lot of items I didn't collect. But I reached a point in the game's narrative where it felt emotionally right to go to the end game. So on my lunch break a few days ago, I grabbed my Switch and I beat Ganon. I kicked his ass. The final battle was a bit of a pushover after 100 hours of, you know, getting the best equipment and building up. But 3 years late to the party, but it's one of the best games I've ever played. I don't regret the time I put into it. I'm really hoping Nintendo announces another Zelda game soon, as is rumored. And speaking of Nintendo, they released a big update for Ring Fit Adventure, the exercise game. And this is good news for a couple reasons. One, it means more Ring Fit stuff. Hooray, there's a new rhythm mode where you can, like, you know, do, like, essentially exercise dancing. And they, like, added, like, new vocal tracks. You have, there's a character, like, in the game who's, like, your little sidekick who's shouting encouragement and exercise tips as you play. And they add, like, different voice options for that. These are all minor things, but the fact that Ring Fit is sold out worldwide right now, and the fact that Nintendo is adding upgrades and updates, suggests they're going to continue supporting it. And I'm really happy to hear that. I'm really happy that it's doing well for them, and that they see a need to keep adding more to it, because I genuinely think this is going to be a game changer for exercise games in general. So if you can find a copy, even though it's sold out,
like that's easy. You know,
it's not easy. Like I told so many friends months ago, hey, Ring Fit's amazing. If you haven't hit a Switch, get it. And now during the pandemic, it's sold out like that. And now they're all texting me saying, why can't I find Ring Fit? I'm saying, you waited too long, you fools. But yeah, once it's back in stock, hopefully before the pandemic's over, it's such a rewarding thing. And I'm really glad to see Nintendo is apparently in it for the long haul.
Very cool. Okay, that brings us to the end of today's Slash Film Daily. You can find more of all of our work at slashfilm.com. You can find this podcast published 3 times a week on Slash Film, iTunes, Google, Overcast, Spotify, all the popular podcast apps. Please feel free to send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns to us at peter@slashfilm.com. And rate and view this podcast on iTunes. Tell your friends. Spread the word. And we will see you on Friday.
Hey, Peter.
Yeah. Oh, I forgot to say this, Jacob. We got this package this past week. I actually forgot about this. I got a package this last week when we were doing an unboxing for our YouTube channel, Ordinary Adventures. And one of the packages was filled with Canadian candy. So me and Ketra tried out all this. It was like a huge, like probably like 10-pound box full of like Canadian candy and chips. It had like ketchup chips and all dressed. I wish Brad was here so we could geek over like all these interesting, unique candies and stuff. But like we just put the YouTube video up on the YouTube channel, so if you want to check that out. So yeah,
well,
yeah,
that's great. In the meantime, I have the gargantuan book of insult, offense, and effrontery, sharp retorts, riposte, caustic quips, implied putdowns by Louis A. Safian, the master of the insult. In front of me. And I've opened it to page 125. Idlers. Idlers. Ben, he's a two-dimensional guy. He has longitude and lassitude.
I genuinely don't know what that last thing is. I'm going to have to look it up while
you move on. Does lassitude mean?
He's a two-dimensional guy. He has longitude and lassitude.
It says a state of physical or mental weariness, lack of energy.
You know, the best jokes are the ones where you have to go to the dictionary and look up a word.
Ben's a two-dimensional guy. He has longitude and lassitude.
Two dimensions.
HT, the only thing she grows in her garden is tired.
That's very true, actually.
That's me.
But I don't get it, why it's in my garden.
Because the only thing you grow in your garden is tired.
Okay.
HT, the only thing she grows in her garden is tired.
Oh no.
Peter, he heard that hard work never killed anybody, but he's taking no chances on being its first victim.
Wow.
And Chris, he's not afraid of hard work. He's fought successfully for years.
Mm-hmm.
And Brad, he's not here, but he stopped drinking coffee in the morning because it keeps him awake the rest of the day. Funny jokes.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.